Stop your grinning and drop your linen. It's time for another go around here on the Silver Screen Podcast. That's right. As you can guess from the brief introduction and the thumbnail, obviously, we're heading right back into a universe filled with terror, xenomorphs, and the unluckiest people alive as we explore another chapter in the Alien franchise. So far, we've been terrified at the original Alien and, well, just honestly bemused at Prometheus, but this time we're going with undoubtedly one of the greatest sequels of all time, James Cameron's Aliens. But before we board that jump ship and head down to LV-426, I have a crew already and prepping for dust off. Come on, I'd have to be crazy to go it alone. First up, he appears with all the frightening inevitability of a xenomorph and a franchise sequel on these things. And he mostly comes out at night, mostly. It's Mr. Mike Wilson.
Yeah, another glorious day in the Corps. A day in the Marine Corps is like a day on the farm. Every meal's a banquet, every paycheck a fortune, every formation a parade. I love the Corps.
Okay, hey, Paul, how you doing?
I'm doing good, man.
Nice one. It's safe to say you've been looking forward to this after our last forays into the universe, isn't that right?
Yes. I mean, I like the Alien franchise, but in particular, spoiler alert, Aliens is my jam. So, and again, I'll get into the reasons why and why this film has some personal connections to me in various ways as we go on. But I have prepared the behind the scenes and things since you're hosting, so we'll get ready for that.
I was going to ask, are you all ready for that BTS section, yeah?
Yeah. We have the briefing on videotape, so you can always feel free to go and watch that.
Awesome. Next up, we have our usual final girl on these things. She's rapidly becoming this show's Ripley. So with this, her third appearance, we've got to make sure she manages to make it to the end of the show without her throwing herself into a furnace. It's Sandy.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. Me and my cats.
And how are things with you?
Really great. Really great. I'm excited for this one.
Nice. As I've said, it's now the third installment of this franchise that you've joined us for. I think it's safe to say that you're a fan of these movies, yeah?
I like them a lot. And what's great is I get inspired to rewatch the entire series every time we do one of these.
Oh, nice. Well, I'm sorry for the last few.
I was genuinely wondering if you'd be brave enough to say, hey, Sandy, you ever been mistaken for a man?
I was going to say that to you, you bitch.
No, have you?
All right. So, Sandy, you'll be volunteering when we eventually get around to Alien v Predator 2 Requiem, yeah?
I will actually be insisting upon it.
Good God. I won't be on that one.
You gotta be here for the bad ones too. You can't just stay.
You can't just do that, dude. Yeah,
I don't mind being here for the bad ones, but it's the absolutely fucking intolerable ones.
Think of all the fun we're gonna have along the way, though.
Nice.
I can't see 90% of that movie, so it's hard to have fun with it. Anyway,
our final guest for this one is now a semi-regular on the channel. He's a writer, producer, director. And from the amount of time he saved us here on the podcast, my only surprise is that he didn't turn up today in a power loader suit. It's Whaley.
Hey, how's it going? My power loader suit's at the dry cleaners.
No, fair enough. How are you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. Looking forward to talking about Aliens.
Nice one. Well, as I say, I mean, you've been with us now talking about a variety of movies, but this is the first one looking at something from this franchise. From a self-confessed horror fan, do these movies hold a special place?
Yeah, they do. They do. They were. Here's the thing. I never considered this horror when I was younger and they came out. This was sci-fi. Yeah. That's all it was to me, is science fiction. I mean, it's got a scary element to it. Now, as a grown adult who watches all sorts of things, yeah, it's definitely horror. It's sci-fi horror, but at the time I never really thought of it as horror, so like I guess it's never held a section in my horror heart. It's always been an awesome sci-fi movie to me.
Nice one. Well, we're glad to have you here, and we'll get on to the discussion shortly. First of all, a question I wanted to ask everybody. Obviously, now there's several films in this franchise. I'm not going to ask what your favourite one is, because we're all going to get very similar answers here. But I am going to ask, from the original design, which movie do you think has the quintessential design for the creature in this? And I'm going to come straight to you, Mike.
I think this one. I think the warrior cast drone from Aliens, personally, is my favorite. I know it's I gather from sort of some of the audience feedback that they're not fond of that one, or of how Cameron kind of multiplies the alien, and you know, to some people makes it less threatening and less scary. But I think it's badass. That's my favorite design.
I've got to say, I do prefer this one, and I'm, you know, I followed the Dark Horse comics that followed on from this for a while, mm-hmm. so this kind of design's burned into my mind almost.
Yeah.
What about you, Whaley? Are you a fan of the dog alien in 3?
No, not as much. I like it, but I prefer this one from Aliens the best.
Cool. What about you, Sandy?
I'm going to make it unanimous. I prefer this one as well. And you do see that imagery keep up throughout the franchise. I think even they felt like it was the best, even in Covenant, like the nest area. That imagery kept popping up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know you, Mike. I know that, you know, it's a very, what comes very close second to this is the alien human hybrid, either from Alien 3 or Romulus. I know you love a bit of that stuff.
It's Alien Resurrection before we get letters.
Oh, Alien Romulus. Resurrection. Shit,
but yes, yeah. They're both really bad.
So. Yeah, you love it. Obviously, today we're talking about Aliens, which is a 1986 science fiction action film. Over to you, Whaley. Written and directed
technically, we're looking at the 1990 version of it. Just
shush. Yes. Stop being a pedant. written and directed by James Cameron. It's the sequel to the 1979 science fiction horror film Alien, and the second film in the Alien franchise, although that's like kind of up in the air now with prequels and shit. despite the success of Alien, the sequel took years to develop due to lawsuits, a lack of enthusiasm from 20th Century Fox, and repeated management changes. Although relatively inexperienced at the time, Cameron was hired to write the story for Aliens in 83 on the strength of his scripts for The Terminator and Rambo. The project stalled repeatedly until new Fox exec Lawrence Gordon pursued a sequel. On an approximately $18.5 million budget, Aliens began principal photography in September 1985 and concluded in January 1986. The film's development was tumultuous and rife with conflicts between Cameron and the British crew at Pinewood Studios. The difficult shoot affected the composer, James Horner, who was also given little time to record the music. The movie itself, the original theatrical cut, was released on July the 18th, 1986, to critical acclaim. Reviewers praised its action, but some criticised the intensity of certain scenes, with Weaver's performance gaining consistent praise, along with those of Bill Paxton and Jeanette Goldstein. It received several awards and nominations, including an Academy Award for Best Actress for Weaver, at a time when the science fiction genre was generally overlooked. It's now considered among the greatest films of the 1980s and among the best science fiction, action, and sequel films ever made, often deemed equal to or better than the original. The special edition was later released on home video in 1990. I don't know where I got that year from, but yeah, thanks, Mike. And so it's available physically on multiple formats, you know, be it DVD, Blu-ray, 4K, which, yes, we'll have our drinking game and go over to Mike. you've got this, haven't you?
I'm staying quiet. I don't know what
you're talking about. No, come on now.
Yeah, I may have watched this on 4K, yes.
Yeah, you were telling me at the time that there's some reputation for it having some strange artifacts on it, but you got through it all right?
Yeah, it's not just this one. It was when they released the bunch of James Cameron films on 4K at the same time a few months ago now, maybe a year or so ago. People were complaining that they had supposedly used AI to enhance the image and that it had given like artificial smoothing and stuff. But I've got to say, I looked out for it on this one and I was a little worried about it, and it either didn't bother me or I didn't notice it. And I was seeing, you know, pores and sweat on brows and everything. So it didn't seem like there was any, you know, artificial face smoothing or anything like that. So either I'm just not as picky as some people or it didn't bother me.
Cool. So it is available on different formats, be it physical or streaming, dependent on your location. I think I saw this one before I even saw the original. I was round at a friend's and they just slapped it on and just blew me away. I absolutely adored this one, and it got to a point where it was literally a weekly watch. I would get back from college every Friday and put this on the player. Absolutely love it. So what about you guys? When was the first time that you saw this? I will say, the special edition, I do remember pre-ordering it from WH Smith's at the time, going back on VHS, and getting a copy, and me and my girlfriend sat there watching it. The girlfriend was completely uninterested, but you know, I didn't pick up on that. The relationship didn't last long. So what about you guys? When was the first time that you saw this, either the theatrical or the special edition? I'll come to you first this time, Sandy.
I did see the theatrical edition when I was younger, but not at the theater. On HBO, I believe it was, with my parents. And we all thought it would be fun to watch because primarily because of Drew Barrymore. Drew Barrymore did E.T., then she did Firestarter, which were these sci-fi and movies with a young kid in it. And this I was just unprepared for. I don't think I stayed. You know, I went to my room and did something else. I couldn't handle it. But later, you know, I did come back to it and watch it and find that I really enjoyed the sci-fi movie, and Sigourney Weaver as well, just like a strong character for a girl to admire.
Yeah. And did you see the special edition when it came out?
No, I didn't see it when it came out. I have seen it once before, but it doesn't appear to be available to me, so I haven't seen that in a while.
Okay, fair enough. What about you, Whaley? When was the first time you saw this?
I honestly think I was probably about 10, and it was on HBO. I think I saw them like back to back, the first and the second one. HBO maybe was having a thing when it was released, and then my family had back when you could hack and get free cable, we had HBO, and I think it was like back to back, so I actually watched them both for the first time at home back to back when I was like 10, like late at night one night on a weekend or something. But and I thought they were both equally great, and special edition, I know I've seen since, I don't remember when. Like, I'm sure when it came out on Blu-ray for the first time, I probably watched it somewhere, but I don't remember.
Cool. And over to you, Mike. When was the first time you saw this?
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of story that I've got about that, because in terms of the first time, I've racked my brain and I genuinely cannot remember when the very first time was that I watched it. It was probably to do with my sister or her group of friends, because she's like 2.5 years older than me. And so her friends would often introduce me to things that were too, you know, old for me movie wise. So I know that it's kind of through them that I saw the Terminator movies and RoboCop and stuff, just when they were hanging out having house parties and it was kind of on and I was around and probably shouldn't have been. So it was probably something like that. I do know that the first time I saw the special edition was when I bought the, what was called the Alien Quadrilogy on DVD. So you can look up when that came out. I'm not genuinely sure. But it's the kind of green box with the alien egg on the front of it. And it was, it's kind of cool because it had alternate versions for all four of the films at that time, which the Blu-ray set kind of followed up and ported over as well, which is cool. So that was when I saw that. But a specific connection that I have to the, well, a couple of connections I have to this film. First of all, on my first year at university, we were given a scene from Aliens to examine and to sort of thoroughly write like multiple essays and examine within an inch of its life. And it was the scenes of basically the dropship dropping to LV-426 and everything. So it was like, it's a pretty long scene. It's about 10 minutes, everything starting from, you know, Marines on the ready line going up to when they're basically at the door of the colony. And so I get virtual PTSD when that particular scene comes on now, because I've seen the film lots of times. I've seen that particular scene about 40, because it was just played on a loop. Like, we'd go into lectures and it would just play on loop on loop on loop, and we had to analyze every inch of like, why are you studying this? And we had to look at the mise-en-scene and the sets and why it's important, because it kind of follows, it tracks the whole journey, which films don't usually do. You know, it follows them basically in real time dropping down. It gives you everything, you know, set up of the weapons and what's going to happen and everything, and gives you everything you need to know about a lot of the characters. So, I mean, I won't go into it for hours on end, but I could, because believe me, we had no freaking choice. So yeah, that kind of cemented at least that scene in the film.
Do you not get completely sick of it now when it comes to that sequence?
that particular scene is just so weird, because I love the film. I've kind of mentioned before, and I've seen it a few times, but that particular scene, it does, as soon as you hit that, as soon as you see, I think it starts with Vasquez and Drake kind of doing maneuvers with the guns. As soon as that happens, I'm like, ugh. I never skip it. I'm never like, oh, let's skip this 10 minutes. But I'm just like, oh, God, I know every inch of this fucking bit of the movie. So, yeah, it's like I said, it's almost PTSD. When that bit comes on, I think I audibly do groan every time now.
What was the other one?
The other connection that I have is that one of my first Comic Cons that I went to, I was lucky enough to meet Colette Hillier, who plays Pharaoh. That's my profile picture, is me with her, because she was really nice and offering free photos and everything and talking with us about the film. And Mark Ralston, who played Drake, was there as well. I didn't speak to him for as long, but I did get a chance to chat with him quickly and got a signed photo. So, yeah, I have kind of fondness for them as people, because they were really nice. And I did get a few stories about the making of the film, particularly from Colette, who was telling me all about how she was Carrie Henn's acting coach during the shooting of the film, which surprised me. I didn't know this. When I told her, I was kind of surprised about it. She was, oh, why is it surprising? Why is that so? I was like, well, you just don't really think about that kind of thing, that kids would need acting teachers as well as, you know, keeping up with their studies and stuff. And I certainly hadn't heard that that was a role that she'd stepped into. So it was interesting hearing about that, and then hearing about how it was made and what it was like. She's moved to England now, so she kind of knew, you know, what it was like around here. But I did say, well, was it a culture shock working here at the time and everything? And it was the convention was just after Bill Paxton had passed. So I asked both of them what it was like working with him and what he was like. And they were just basically really full of praise. And, oh, he's a riot. He's a real laugh. Just a nice guy, you know, it's professional, but always fun. So, yeah, it kind of cemented my love for the film. And from that convention, I took away some signed photos and a film cell that I probably spent too much money on that's hung up in my room, in my living room here, a cell from Aliens with the little reproduction film poster.
Do you remember the first time that you saw the special edition?
Yeah, no, as I said, it was when I bought the Quadrilogy box set, because it had different versions of everything. So that was the
first
time.
That was in 2003, by the way.
Okay, so I would have been 21. So there you go.
Time flies.
That would have been just before I studied it at university then, like, because it would have been about a year before.
So when they said we're studying it, you were like, oh, fantastic. And then after, yeah, you're like, oh, God, not
I
again.
I don't have to do any more work. I've already studied.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, yeah, we'll get on to the actual talking about that movie in a moment. But, yeah, as I say, we've switched roles for this one. So we're going to go over to you, Mike, because, yeah, you've not done enough talking on this one. I'm joking, dude. What have you got for us from behind the scenes?
Well, as the BTS goes, as we've mentioned, filming was difficult on the movie, as James Cameron, a Canadian, had little familiarity with British film industry traditions such as tea breaks, which interrupted production for up to an hour each weekday, and he was frustrated at losing hours of filming every week. In the book The Making of Aliens, author J.W. Rinsler described Cameron as aggressive and certain of what he wanted, which irked the crew. The situation was exacerbated by Cameron's hands-on approach, often modifying setups such as lighting himself to fit his vision without involving the unionized crew, which is a no-no. The crew was dismissive of Cameron for his relative inexperience at the time, thinking he'd not done enough to earn such a prominent position, and that producer Gail Ann Hurd had her job only because she was his partner. Cinematographer Dick Bush, stud, and first AD, first AD Derek Cracknell frequently ignored Cameron's requests. Cracknell was fired early in production, upsetting the crew. The situation deteriorated so much that at different points, both the Pinewood crew and Cameron and Hurd walked out. When filming did finally conclude at Pinewood, Cameron told the crew, "This has been a long and difficult shoot fraught by many problems, but the one thing that kept me going through it all was the certain knowledge that one day I would drive out the gate of Pinewood and never come back, and that you sorry bastards would still be here." He described most of the crew as lazy, insolent, and arrogant. On the other hand, Bill Paxton called the crew's work impeccable, but their attitude was more relaxed than the American crew's to which he was accustomed. So take that as you will, I suppose. In April 1985, conflict turned to the cast. Fox did not want Sigourney Weaver to return because they expected her to demand a high salary. Cameron and Hurd were insistent Weaver return as the solo star. Fox refused, saying it would damage the studio's negotiating power with Weaver's agent. Cameron and Hurd again left the project, marrying and going on a honeymoon. When they returned, the Aliens project was ready to move forward, which Cameron credits to producer Lawrence Gordon. who got the film eventually greenlit. The title Aliens reportedly came from Cameron writing Alien on a whiteboard during a pitch meeting and then adding a dollar suffix, which I love. Cameron turned in the finished script in February 1985, hours before a Hollywood writer's strike. He recalled the audience reactions when seeing Alien in the theater and believed it would be difficult to recreate the emotion and novelty of the original. He and Gail Hurd agreed to combine the horror of Alien with the action of the Terminator. Cameron reportedly said if the first film can be compared to a haunted house, Aliens should be like a roller coaster. He believed in having a strong female heroine to distinguish his films from typical Hollywood action fare and wrote the script apparently with a picture of Sigourney Weaver on his desk. He referred to the Terminator and how he removed the normal protective forces from Sarah Connor so she had to fend for herself. We kind of talked about that during our Terminator review. Cameron has also always wanted to make a film about space infantry, which is why you get the Colonial Marines in this one. Moving on to the cast now. According to Lance Henriksen, Bill Paxton was unaware he'd be involved in the knife trick scene until it was filmed, and Henriksen did nick Paxton's finger during the reshoot. So, oh dear. again, talking about the Alien Warriors that we were earlier, in redesigning the Alien Warriors, Cameron remained faithful to Geiger's work. H.R. Geiger, of course, did the first Aliens. While building on it, conscious that the creatures would be seen by audiences as people in costumes, he enhanced the designs by extending their arms and often filmed them hung from wires or from atypical positions to make them appear more inhuman. The aliens were played by dancers and stuntmen in lightweight costumes, which allowed them to move quickly. Several 8-foot mannequins were used for aliens that were contorted into inhuman poses. Although hordes of alien creatures appear to be in the film, there were only actually 12 suits. Simple black leotards covered in molded foam were used for faster moving shots, and detailed models with articulated upper bodies and mouths for close-ups. When the aliens were shot and destroyed, puppets were hung up and detonated. So, yeah. A deleted scene in Alien, which we talked about again during our review of that, established a life cycle for the alien creatures in which a life form would be cocooned and transformed into an egg that then birthed a facehugger. Inspired by a beehive-like hierarchy, Cameron believed the vast field of eggs on the derelict alien craft would come from a much larger creature, a queen, with the other alien creatures serving as drones. Stan Winston described Cameron's initial queen design as a combination of a praying mantis and Tyrannosaurus Rex, influenced by the Alien Warrior design. Cameron said dinosaur influences were unintentional as he considered them boring. Come back next week for more on that not being true. His goal was to extrapolate on Geiger's warrior designs to create a large and powerful creature that was also swift and overtly female, describing it as, quote, hideous and beautiful at the same time, like a Black Widow spider. What are you doing with Black Widow spiders, James Cameron? Jeez. The queen has elongated large forelimbs with smaller secondary ones underneath, but Winston redesigned the legs by adding a double joint to make it more inhuman. Cameron and Winston worked on several concepts to vivify the queen, including large puppets, miniatures, and costumes with several people inside. A frame was built large enough to hold two people, covered in black polythene bags and hung on a crane. By the way, there's footage of this on the DVDs and Blu-rays, and if you haven't seen it, it is faintly hilarious. I do recommend going to see it. This weird alien frame with like bin bags just flapping about all over it is pretty amusing. The final alien queen was a 14-foot puppet made of lightweight polyurethane foam. Two people sat inside to control the arms. The legs were controlled by rods connected at the ankles, and a separate person whipped the tail around with fishing line. The head was manipulated with a combination of servo motors and hydraulics controlled by up to four people. The effect was hidden by lighting, steam, slime, and smoke. Aliens is credited with expanding the franchise's scope. With additions to the series' backstory and factions such as the Colonial Marines, it inspired a wealth of merchandise, including video games, comic books, toys, and of course it was followed by multiple sequels and prequels. And finally, the reason that we are talking about the special edition of this movie today, specifically, is because it is my sort of preferred version. I think it really does genuinely give you more than the original one did. And we'll talk about a little bit about the changes in a second, because I do have a little breakdown. But I did want to say, far from being just my preferred version, who am I? We could potentially hear from the horse's mouth why it's the preferred version of the film. So give me one second, and here's James Cameron.
This is Jim Cameron. And what you're about to watch is the special edition of Aliens. I actually prefer this version to the release version because I think, as it's been best described by one of my friends, it's 40 miles of bad road. And I think it's a longer, more intense, and more suspenseful version of the film. The conventional wisdom at the time was, don't make the film too long. But at 2 hours and 37 minutes, this is the ride that we intended you to take. So enjoy it.
So yeah, I think that's kind of fairly self-explanatory and fairly convincing, for me at least. And if you aren't familiar with the changes in the special edition, there's about 17 minutes of additional footage. And they include, for me, a very important scene thematically, which is where Ripley learns of her daughter's death from Burke, that she basically lived to old age and died in the time Ripley had been frozen. There's a more detailed look at the colony before the infestation, including a scene of the captain from Red Dwarf appearing, as I mentioned to you, DK, as I was watching. And various scenes, including again a scene that I really think we kind of needed, which was the scene of the of Newt's family going out to discover the ship from the first movie, and you know, the ultimate revelation that when they return to their kind of, I guess, recreational vehicle or whatever, that they open the door, Dad has a facehugger attached to Newt's dad, sorry, has a facehugger attached. So you meet her parents and her brother in that scene as well. There's scenes that show, you know, them receiving the orders from Burke to go and approach the ship after hearing from Ripley. And there's additional scenes of the sentry guns taking out a vast majority of the aliens, which again, I kind of think was nice to have, just because it helps to explain why, you know, all these multiple hundreds of aliens are suddenly vastly reduced in number by the end of the movie. And there might be more, but that's all basically I was able to kind of come up with. And if you can think of anything else, DK, by all means, feel free to chime in. And that's otherwise all of the BTS.
Yeah, you've pretty much covered everything with regards to that. Have you got any more as we go?
I have, Leah. Just as we hit per each section, I've got little bits and pieces, but not hopefully too much.
Cool. Well, I mean, you know, as always, we will go through the different sections, be it writing, direction, acting. So we'll come to writing first. And do you have anything, you know, you might as well carry on with that if you've got anything for the writing, mate.
Just one quick thing, yeah. When production of The Terminator was delayed for 9 months because Arnold Schwarzenegger was contractually obligated to Conan the Destroyer, Cameron used the time to develop his treatment, expanding it to 90 pages. He drew ideas from something called Mother, one of his story concepts about an alien on a space station involving a power loader suit. Because of the low expectations for The Terminator, Cameron spent much of his free time during that production developing and trying out script ideas for Alien 2.
Cool. Yeah, so, you know, originally story by Cameron Gyler and Walter Hill, and screenplay by Cameron. So I'm going to come to you guys, and what do you think to the writing on this? Do you think it's good? Do you think it's bloated? Any particular, I mean, it's filled. It's, you know, before we even start, it's filled with quotable dialogue. Me and Mike were talking about this earlier prior to recording, because Mike said, you know, there's at least three openings you could use with it. Did I use one?
Yes, yeah. That was, and then I used one of the others.
All right, fair enough. Yeah, so, yeah, we're getting this one's worth here today, folks. So with regards to the writing, how does it stand for you? And I'm going to throw this open to anybody that wants to chime in.
I thought the beginning was a bit clunky, but once we got on the planet, it really takes off. And I don't know if that's so much the writing or the editing or, you know, things they had to cut for time, that clunkiness in the beginning and the Marines just looking like, you know, freaking really teenagers. But then that, you know, really thankfully all changed once we got on planet. And from there, it's just spectacular pacing, of course, and reasons for doing things, especially the crescendo where everybody does a smart thing and says, let's get the F out of here. And then they can't. Yeah. It's just really great.
Cool. Wiley?
I do think that. The writing is, it's good. I do think, you know, I could tell what they were trying to do. Like after you said, they were wanting to get more action and stuff like that. There's definitely, you can definitely tell that they tweak story to go with that vein. Like, you know, a car chase scene, basically kind of thing. Technically, I guess a version of a tank in the future. I mean, you could tell there were some things added to it, but overall, I mean, I thought it still had a very good story. And I do think the beginning was clunky as well, but I think on the special edition is why it's preferable, is that it's less clunky because of the scenes with the planet, with the Newt's family and all those other things. I think that 100% makes it less clunky at the beginning.
So you think, do you both think there's a little too much exposition for a sequel?
I don't personally, no.
I don't. Too much.
I don't think it's too much. I think it did well for, I mean, we know what world we're in, but it's been 70 years or what, 50 something years or whatever it was since the first one. Things have changed. And I love the, you know, anti-capitalism sentiments there from even in 86.
Come on then, Mike. You'll go again.
I just have so much about this because one of the things I love about this film is that, you know, people I think often disregard it or write it off as just dumb, like action film type fun. And yet I think thematically, it's probably for me, the most rich written story, you know, in the Alien franchise or movie, sorry. And it comes to a lot of the stuff that we mentioned about in our review of Alien. So I mentioned like in that one that it was kind of the way the alien was represented was kind of like, you know, an evil sexuality, and they were a representation of male kind of, you know, sexual violence towards them, etc. This film, I think one of the strongest things that you can take from it is that it's a film about motherhood, and it is very much good mum versus bad mum. And I think that's why you get the introduction of the alien queen, and her and Ripley are specifically, you know, they are the big clash of the movie. I think that's why they introduced Newt as someone that Ripley can kind of literally have as a surrogate daughter. That's a lot more effective than a cat. So you kind of have that. And then obviously, as I said, the queen has her drones and stuff, and there's just so much of that. And I think, again, that's why I appreciate in the special edition version when it actually emphasizes that by showing that Ripley is a mother. She had a daughter of her own, and she's kind of sad, you know, part of her sadness at being frozen for so long and entering this new world is that her daughter is dead. She never knew her. And she promised to be home for like, what she says, oh, I promised to be home for her 11th birthday. Okay, and she died at like 66 years old or something before Ripley was ever found. So I think it reinforces all those things. And she even has scenes where she talks to Newt about like, oh no, I had a daughter once, but she's gone. And Newt being Newt is like, what, you mean dead? But again, yeah, there's so many sweet scenes of the two of them together where Ripley's trying to be maternal towards her. And yeah, as I say, I think maybe it's just me. I don't know if you guys feel the same way.
I do think it plays into that simply because of the fact that, especially in the special edition where you see, you know, Newt's biological parents at the start. And there's not really a semblance that they're bad parents as such. They're just, you know, obviously they're more concerned with trying to survive. And so maybe they take them a little bit for granted. And then when you've got the scene with, you know, as you've mentioned, with Ripley's daughter, and she's upset. So when it comes to that dynamic between them, I do like how it goes. They kind of adopt each other, as it were, to the point where at the end of the film, you know, Newt calls her mommy. Yeah, I do like that.
It's not a conscious decision either. It's just purely instinctual on Ripley's part to take her under, you know, her wing and become so fiercely protective of her.
Yeah.
And I think it's telling that, like, in this story, there aren't really, when it comes to those two main forces, there's no paternal figures. You never learn about Ripley's child's father. And obviously the queen, there's no paternal figure there. They're both kind of single mothers.
Alcone was a little bit paternal.
Well, I mean, there are figures that you can kind of put that onto. And certainly in the special edition, there's a lot more hints of a romance between Ripley and Hicks, which kind of feeds into the nuclear family sort of idea at the end, that they've kind of formed their own family with, I suppose, Bishop would be the loyal pet, I guess. You know, but again, this feeds into another theme that I'll talk about in a little bit, which is like Ripley basically becoming the masculine ideal and the kind of strong male hard body. And she basically gets given that role, learning from Hicks. He's the one that teaches her how to use weapons, etc. But ultimately, he's the one that ends up injured and damaged, and she has to kind of take on that traditional "quote unquote" role.
Oh, even, so woke,
you know, down to, you know. Just, I know, right? Bloody woke.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I said I'd talk about it later. I just talked about it there, but yeah, that's the kind of. I think, yeah, the scene of Ripley kind of gearing up is effectively her, you know, in a sense, transforming into the masculine action hero archetype. Without actually becoming, you know, oh, we're now becoming a male or whatever. Although, again, some people, if this film was to come out today, would be like, oh, yeah, oh, it's going to turn into a man. Oh,
yeah.
Oh.
Her short hair, guys. She's got short hair. That obviously means she's a man.
Exactly. Just don't even get me started on the next film when she shaves it completely.
Oh, yeah. it's one of those scenes as well. I mean, I know you get them in things like Rambo, but that gearing up scene is pretty much iconic. It's been copied so many times since. think, yeah, it could be construed as a little clunky at the start, but once it hits its stride, it moves along with such a brisk pace that before you know it, the movie's, you know, at its end. I think there's some really good storytelling here, some really effective movie storytelling.
Especially when you find out that they didn't actually disbelieve her story about the aliens.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, some of them did. I think it's, although again, I don't know if it's that's me, but I think there's a criticism of, as Whaley said, capitalism, but also corporatism. And I think certain corporate factions do disbelieve it, and they're just like, oh, the money you've wasted. But obviously Burke and that kind of special weapons division side are like,
interesting.
What we could exploit.
Yeah. It's and I think there's some really, really good dialogue in here. I mean, it's not Shakespeare, but the amount of quotable lines, you could be here for quite a while just batting those back and forth.
Yeah, I do have to shout out because, again, we talk about all the various themes and stuff, and one of the lines I think that cuts to the core of it, if you didn't already pick up on it in regards to the kind of critique of corporate culture and capitalism, and I think we brought it up on a different review, but I can't remember why, and it's the line where Ripley basically says to Burke, I don't know which species is worst, at least you don't see them screwing each other over for a damn percentage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Just immediately making the subtext into text. Okay.
The first time you watched it, did you cotton on to Burke being a bit of a shyster, or were you as surprised when he had his heel turn?
It had been such a long time since I'd seen it. I vaguely remembered Paul Reiser being an asshole, but it had been a while.
And so when just Paul Reiser.
When he first came on the screen, I was like, oh, wait. I was like, oh, he seems like a good guy. And then when it got a little further, I was like, oh, wait, I remember now. No, yeah. So, yeah, I could say the first time watching it, yes, I could see the turn being more surprising. But
yeah. I mean, the first time I watched it, I knew him from My Two Dads. So it was just a complete role reversal.
I watched that show.
Yeah.
I remember from Mad About You was the one that I first got introduced to him.
I watched that show too.
Yeah.
So,
Was good them using him because it was just such a surprise when you found out, you know, what he was up to. When that moment when he traps them in the room and basically,
Yeah, actually, I was initially surprised about it because I was kind of just taking it on face value. And it's one of the things that, again, I like about the writing is that it subverts what you expect in some ways. So, yeah, with Burke, I was believing it until exactly what you said, Sandy. I fully hated him when he trapped Ripley and Newt in the room purely with the intention of letting the facehuggers get them. And I was like, oh, this guy has to die, you know, at that point. But in a sort of like related note to that, I was with Ripley in really distrusting Bishop because of what happened with Ash in the previous movie. And I love that the film doesn't play that easy. And at the end of it, he's actually been like the most noble and self-sacrificing one of them all, because it would be really dull to just repeat the beats of the same movie and be like, oh, the robot's evil again. But naturally, you understand why she's paranoid about it. So
yeah, I think they write Bishop really well, and you know, without treading too far into another, another category, I think Lance Henriksen plays him beautifully, because you can see the disappointment on his face and from the way he's treated. But unlike David in the later movie, he never like gets out to go for revenge or put the human people in their place. He's a genuinely nice android. Oh, yeah.
But there's something about Lance Henriksen that does seem like, you don't know why, but there's the belief that there might be something sinister, even though he's on the surface, he's being really nice and pleasant, and yet you just think, I don't know, yeah, there's something about you.
Yeah, you do expect a bit of a turn, but it never comes through. So, yeah, I do like that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us, because we were expecting that, I think at the very end scene where it looks like he's basically buggered off, we're like, oh no, what's she going to do now? So when he does come back and it's like, oh, I'm so sorry, that platform was unstable, I just had to try and circle around and hope for the best. I was like, all right, okay, you got me again.
I'm not Cameron's biggest fan, but he can write and direct a decent film. I don't know why he's not doing it these days.
Person.
But
because he's got to make 17 Avatar freaking movies, apparently.
Yeah. You know, because we're talking about Cameron, we'll stick with him and move into direction. And have you got anything on this one, Mike?
Very probably. Let me just scroll down till I find. Yes, I do. Cameron obviously wanted to direct this project, but he was a relatively new director, his only directing credit being Piranha 2 The Spawning, a low-budget independent horror film. And if you don't know the story, there's basically... all reports are that Cameron basically didn't direct that. He was locked out of it, and it was the film's producers that effectively did it and just gave him a credit. So the studio was reluctant to grant his request. His credibility was elevated following the surprise financial and critical success of The Terminator in late 1984, and so the studio gave him the job. Cameron's associates tried to persuade him to reject the offer, believing that anything good about this film would be attributed to Alien director Ridley Scott and anything negative to Cameron. As for Ridley Scott, he said he was never offered the chance to direct the sequel, possibly because he was difficult to work with on the original. Seems to be a theme with these movies. Cameron also wanted his collaborative partner and girlfriend, Gail Ann Hurd, to serve as the producer, but Fox did not take the request seriously, believing she couldn't stand up to Cameron. Conversely, he believed she was the only person who would stand up to him. Hurd had several industry associates contact Fox execs to convince them that she was a legitimate producer. There we go. That's all I have.
Cool. So, yeah, what do you guys think to the direction on this? And again, I'll throw it open to anybody. Anybody wants to chime in, go for it.
I think it's good. Like, I don't think it's like anything that's like, oh, breath, like something new, something amazing with the direction of it. But I think it's very well directed. I mean, it's one of the top in the Alien franchises. I mean, I like it equally as Alien, but you know, it's, they both do two different things a little bit with the, in the same world. And but I thoroughly enjoyed the direction of it.
Is there anything in particular that you enjoy? Any particular shots or the way he creates a scene?
I think the something I think Cameron does well is some stuff with action, and I think the fight with the queen at the end is good. It builds tension. I knew what was going to happen, obviously, watching it again. But like, it, like, you're like, oh no, this is bad, things are happening and stuff like that. So the way that was crafted and executed was very well done. And I thought, you know, that was one of my favorite scenes for directing in this.
Yeah. There's a couple of scenes that stand out to me. One is the first one when they're under the reactor, where the Marines get their ass whooped for the first time. Yes. It's like a bit of a masterclass in tension, and then it's like someone's lit the blue torch paper and all hell's breaking loose. And I think it adequately conveys the chaos of those situations, especially when it cuts to those head cams. And the shouting out for Wiesbowski and stuff like that. I think it's done really well. And the second one is what we touched upon before, which is the scene where Ripley wakes up after looking after Newt under that cot, and her pulse rifle's gone, and the canisters are open with the facehuggers, and you get this. Even you know what happens, but even still, even now when I watch it, when it cuts to that shot of the canisters open. Just get a sinking feeling in your stomach while you're watching this.
Yeah. I've kind of already said to you off air about different stuff. I don't like kids in peril stuff. And so, yeah, that scene is difficult for me to watch.
Yeah.
At least Ripley's in there with her, though, I guess. So,
yeah. But, yeah, so go on, Sandy, definitely, what about you?
Yeah, he definitely has a way of building up the intensity, even just... through a couple of the scenes, even though I've seen this before several times, I would just notice my posture in the chair. I have like decorded posturing, and like my arm is folding in on itself. It's just so intense, some of those scenes. And I do like that, different from Alien. There wasn't as much claustrophobia. You know, we were more out in the open. There's certainly a couple of tight spaces, but it was less about the alien out of the corner of your eye, and it was all in your face this time. We got to see so much, whereas there was one tactic before, it was the unseen that gave you fear. And in this one, it was just in your face horror. And I just really appreciated that about the directing. And again, bringing up the child actor, never easy to work with a child actor, and she was very well directed.
Yeah. Mike?
I mean, yeah, just I kind of already touched on it, but I think I will say that I think people that write this off as being the all-action one and it doesn't have as much suspense as the first movie, I push back against that a little. I think there's a lot of scenes that are just as suspenseful as that first film. And I think that, yeah, as Sandy said, some of it's out in the open, but Cameron does use enclosed spaces quite a lot as well and uses them in clever ways that the first movie doesn't. Like, for example, when they're seeing something on the tracker and then Ripley says, well, that would be basically in the room. What are you talking about? And then they realize, oh, shit, there's three dimensions in the world. There's something can be above us. They just look up and like, oh, crap. So I love that scene when they look to shine the light and there's all those aliens crawling off the ceiling towards them. And it's like, oh, you're in trouble. And any scenes of like the way Newt hides in the ducts and stuff or the way she gets taken by the one alien. In that little pool of water, sewage water, whatever it is. And just so many cool moments like that. But like you said as well, special shout out to the way that they use, and again, it probably isn't unique. I don't know if this was the first time, and I know it's been used since, but the idea of using the body cams and stuff on the soldiers to show the events. So for me, it makes it all the more suspenseful when they find Mary and she's kind of alive and they don't realize she has a chest burster, but you're seeing it through the kind of the hazy, infrared-y type camera. And then even when I forget the character's name, but when the female character says like, oh, did they even show up on infrared? And the alien's literally behind her and bounces on her. And it's like, oh, crap. So there's lots of really good moments like that. And again, as an overall piece, I think the way that it builds up the tension is just, it's brilliant. It does, it starts off perhaps a bit slow for some people, but it really does elevate it right the way up to 11 by the end when you have, Power Loader versus Alien Queen. You can't deny that you've been on a ride and it really has amped up that tension.
For sure.
As I said earlier, I think there's a lot of things which you don't really notice until you're actually analysing it for a bloody film class that makes you analyse it a million times. But there's an awful lot of stuff that occurs almost in real time, and there's a lot less of the kind of the filmmakers that would go like, scene cut, and 7 hours later, this is where we pick up. There's an awful lot of things that play out in their entirety, which again aids to the suspense. And yeah, like I said, as much as I know this because I had to review it, I do think credit where it's due for the scene where, Cameron spends 10 minutes following them getting to a planet where any other science fiction film would just be like, okay, we're leaving the ship now. Okay, now we've come into the, there's no quick and easy cutting between things. We are seeing every minute of this. We're getting prepared and it builds up like, what are we going to do? What are we going to face? What weapons do we have? What are these people like? Are they going to be reliable? And I think it also gives you a chance to get to know some of the Colonial Marines characters a lot better. Not so much the ones that are blatantly cannon fodder, but I mean, one of the things people always talk about with these films is they have come to love like Hudson, Hicks, Vasquez, these characters that are actual characters. And I mean, as much as people might prefer the first movie, can you really say any of the characters other than Ripley are really characters in that? They are all basically just cannon fodder that are there to scream and die. Yeah. For me, anyway.
I will agree with Sandy on that. It's in the first film, it's very much hidden. It's very much, the thing that's out of the corner of your eye. Whereas in this, they're there. They're staring you right in the face. But the trick with Cameron is, in this, it doesn't make them any less scary. It makes them more, with the sheer amount that's coming at them.
Oh, and I have to say, I have to give it a shout out for this suspenseful moment because it's really well written, but it's only in the special edition when they've set up the sentry guns and you see the sentry gun ammo just basically draining more and more. And okay, it's taken out tons of the alien drones, but the ammo's basically going to next to nothing. And then I think the ammo gets to like 10 shots left and the aliens give up. And they're just like, they could literally just walk up to the door next time. And one of them goes, yeah, but they don't know that. So we kind of just have to hope they don't try it.
Yeah.
That just adds so much suspense to a scene. It's like, it looks like we've got a weapon against them. We don't.
I will say as well, going back to the woke thing and people, dissing things that they just don't understand. I do like that, and you'll know this, Mike, the briefing where it's putting up the flashcards for the crew of the Nostromo.
Mm-hmm.
It shows Veronica Cartwright's character, as having been born a male.
Yeah, I mentioned that during our review of Alien. It's very progressive for the time. I mean, it's barely there and it's in the background, but still.
Yeah, but I do like that. It will have got some people, it'll pressure up.
On the less progressive side, I kind of have to mention, because it's a bit of an elephant in the room, don't love that they basically just did brownface to a non-ethnic actress to play Vasquez.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure that would fly nowadays, to be perfectly honest.
I didn't even know that. I didn't even notice or know that that was that they had done that.
I mean, if you see Jeanette Goldstein in Terminator 2,
I didn't recognize her from anything else. So,
I will say that for years I did think Jeanette Goldstein was Latina.
No, she's not. And I, if you look, there's some very uncomfortable things in the making of, which again, you know, a product of its time, even if it's the 80s and whatever. But there's a lot of like, we applied things to darken her skin and cover her freckles, and I was like, and you don't think this is a bit dodgy? You're basically admitting to brown facing somebody, man.
Yeah. What do you think to Cameron's beef then with the British employees? Do you think he had a point, or do you think he was just, you know, this character that he gets lambasted as quite a lot?
Given everything we've heard about Cameron, I think it's firmly on him. The fact that even on one of his other movies, I think they had T-shirts that were like, "You can't scare me, I worked for James Cameron." He's just clearly a bit of a prick.
Here's the thing. I agree Cameron can be a prick, but I also think from how you read that story earlier too, they didn't give him any kind of benefit of the doubt. Mm. I think it's like 80-20. I don't think there's anybody not at fault, you know, sort of thing. But if you're a crew that's been doing it for a while and you see all these directors come and go like that, and if you have the thought process like, oh, he hasn't been doing this long enough for me to respect him, like as a thought prior to doing it. Now, granted, they may have had that thought, and then Cameron came in and said something. And they're like, "Oh, okay, well, we don't." But still, like, there's being a director, there's a hierarchy on set. Like, my number one rule is don't be an asshole, and Cameron obviously doesn't follow that. However, like, you gotta, if you're going in automatically going, "Well, who's this guy?" Like, is the thing, you shouldn't be part of that crew.
I will kind of, to give the other side of it, I will say I think he was absolutely right to hire his AD, because by all accounts, the AD was kind of, Cameron was asking him to do something and he was going, no, you don't know what you want. I'll do it my way. And then Cameron was having to go undo everything he'd done, do it the way he asked for in the first place. And I was like, yeah, you can't work like that. That's just the person that's meant to be helping you, undermining you. And I'm with you on that.
That's one of my biggest pet peeves on set is like, and honestly, that's who I pick the people that work with me. I'm much smaller with it. So I'm not hiring a crew of people I don't know. But at the same time, like, I'm sure that's going to eventually happen if I get paid to do stuff with decent money. But like, you've got to set a precedent on your set, and you've got to do that. Like, a whole thing of film is collaboration. And if there's people not believing in you, not wanting to, like, you're not collaborating well. Cameron's a dick, and I 100% believe that he was 80% of that problem.
That's fair enough. Yeah, so we'll get on to the acting now with regards to this. I mean, what have you got on this one, Mike? Come on.
What have I got? So, yeah, Sigourney Weaver rejected initial offers to return, despite being interested after reading Cameron's script. She had to be convinced Aliens was not being made exclusively for financial reasons. Clearly, she hadn't been in Hollywood long. Weaver received a $1 million, equivalent to $2.87 million in 2024 salary, and a percentage of the box office profits, the highest salary of her career at the time. Negotiations were so lengthy that Cameron and Heard told Schwarzenegger's agent they intended to write Ripley out of the movie, knowing that Weaver's agent would be told, and terms were reached shortly afterward, even though they actually had no intention of writing her out of the movie. Typical Hollywood tactics. So, yeah. Cameron wanted an unknown actor to play Newt. Agents scouted Hen while she was at school in Lake and Heath, England. And though she lacked acting experience, Cameron said she had a great face and expressive eyes. Stephen Lang, who would later go on to appear in the Avatar films, auditioned for the role of Hicks, but it was James Remar who secured the role, star of the legendary Mortal Kombat Annihilation. I was waiting on it. He left shortly into filming, ostensibly due to urgent family matters or creative differences with Cameron, but he has since later admitted he was fired after being arrested for drug possession. Yeah, that's all over the special features as well on this. Heard hired Michael Biehn the following Friday. Paxton credited his casting as Hudson to a chance encounter with Cameron at LA International Airport, during which he mentioned he'd be interested in a role. Fox supported Paxton's casting because of positive feedback for his performance in Weird Science in 1985. Paxton was worried the character would annoy audiences till he realized he was comic relief for the tense scenes. Henriksen was concerned about portraying Bishop after other recent successful portrayals of android characters like Ian Holm in Alien and Rutger Hauer in Blade Runner. He played Bishop as an innocent child who pities the short-lived humans, apparently. And finally, the Colonial Marine cast features a mix of British and American actors who underwent 3 weeks of intensive training with the British Special Air Service, SAS. Vietnam War veteran Al Matthews played Apone. He's actually a vet. He helped to train the actors, teaching them how to handle firearms properly because their blanks were still hazardous. Before he left, James Remar accidentally shot a hole through the set of Frank Oz's Little Shop of Horrors on an adjacent stage. Love that. Probably on drugs at the time. But the training was intended to help the Marine cast develop camaraderie and treat other actors like Weaver, Ricer, etc. as outsiders. Bean's late casting caused him to miss the training, and he said he regretted being unable to customize his armor as the other actors had done because he just inherited James Remar's. Cameron created a distinct backstory for each Marine and instructed the actors to read Starship Troopers so that they'd understand the Space Marine archetype. There we go.
Cool. So, yeah, I mean, it's although we've got a few principal players, it's quite a large cast on this one. So I'm wondering who stood out for you with regards to this. And, I'll come to you first, Sandy.
Well, definitely... Bill Paxton is one of the ones that stood out and had a lot of great lines. Yeah. And then Michael, is it Bean? Is that how you say it?
Bean. Yeah. I think it's Bean, yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. Bean.
Him, of course. Oh,
that's a whole new film.
And then even though we lost him early, Mark Ralston was great and recognizable and kind of creepy. But I think that's just his look that he has about him. But I think those are the three main standouts for me in the franchise. And then Sergeant Appon also.
Yeah. All right, you, Wiley.
I'm a big fan of Newt Carey. Yeah. I thought, especially knowing. I knew that was her first movie after looking her up, but. How they discover and stuff like that. I think she did a great job. I did see that she has started acting again.
She has?
Yeah, she's got something on IMDb for like in 2020.
Oh.
As an actress. And I was like, oh, interesting. It's called Thunder Island as a union worker in 2020. So, I mean, I don't say that's regular. She did something. Yeah, it's interesting. But, yeah, no, I thought she did a great job. I'm assuming working on Cameron's set scared her off of acting anymore.
She did good with her accent, too. You could hear it every once in a while, a little bit of Brit slipping out, but she did really good.
She sounded fully Australian, you know. I was thoroughly convinced. It's because the British faking American, it came up to me sounding really weirdly Australian.
Also, I hated the character, but I liked Paul Reiser's performance and of course Sigourney's, you know, gold standard. But yeah, those were my top three.
Cool. Mike?
I'm probably going to end up just seconding what everyone else said. Obviously, you know, Bill Paxton is the comic relief and the quotable one. And you can see why, you know, his career went from strength to strength. I mean, from Weird Science to Aliens to a million other things, you know, and I think he is a great loss as a character actor of sorts because he can kind of elevate what could be a potentially annoying or dumb role. Obviously, you know, Michael Bean, Terminator and Aliens, he's in two of my favorite things. I think he's really good here in that role as well. You know, Sigourney Weaver, just flawless, just amazing, brilliant at everything from, you know, kicking ass of the Marines to get, you know, things done to being a surrogate mum. And
we forgot Lance Henriksen too.
Yeah, as I said earlier, I think Lance Henriksen, brilliant performance because you really, I guess you've got no reason to be suspicious of him, but there's just something about Lance Henriksen's demeanor that's like, okay. I mean, there's reason in terms of what happened with the previous android, but you don't necessarily have any reason not to take him as face value when he's like, oh yeah, the old models were crap, but couldn't happen now. I'm not allowed to harm you and blah, blah, blah. So I kind of love when it turns around and he is nice. But like I said, there's something about Henriksen's demeanor and persona as an actor that's just like,
Yeah, especially Especially when he says something like that, it automatically puts you on edge because you think, hey, up. You know?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And then you have to wonder him nicking himself if he didn't. I mean, it just feels highly unlikely that he did it on accident.
Maybe.
I personally think Carrie Henn did a really good job. I mean, it's very surprising to me that she didn't go on to have a bigger career, but apparently she just wanted to go back to school and become a teacher.
Yeah.
So, yeah. With regards to the next category, we're going to get on to production design now. So what you got for us on this time, Mike?
I have literally nothing. Sorry.
Yay! Thank you for saving my ass, because I've got nothing either. So, yeah, what do you guys think to the production design on this? I can't really fault it. There's that little bit at the end where, you know, Ripley's waiting for the alien to come up in the elevator. She's holding on to Newt. Everything's collapsing. It always reminds me of a back projection. But other than that...
It does a bit, yeah.
Yeah, but other than that, I can't really fault this. I think it still looks good to this day.
Can I just ask, when the Queen goes up in that elevator, how is she pushing the button?
Her tail.
Duh.
Come on, Michael.
Okay. All right. Okay.
That thing is. She can aim that to try to stab somebody with it. They can and put it through someone's back. She can press a button with it.
Okay, I'll let you off. All right.
Or even she has a little head inside of her that can press a button in her mouth. So.
She spat a little mouth from the inside.
I really wish I was a better artist. I would like to have someone draw that.
I want to believe that's how she did it. Just the equivalent of us sticking a tongue out and stabbing it with our tongue.
Yeah, it's more like a Russian doll than you think. It just keeps coming out.
They don't show it, but an actual tiny little human hand comes out of the other mouth inside of it that presses the button.
And flips you off.
I will never forget, in terms of the alien design, the stupidest funny joke, but I can't not picture it now, is when Family Guy was doing Alien, and they had their kind of camp character voice, and it was like, I'm going to eat you. I'm going to eat you. Then the small bit comes out, and it goes, I like to eat you with my little mouth, too.
Yeah. I thought production design was really good. There was only one time that I was like, ooh, bad CGI. But for all the practical stuff was still fantastic, and for everything they did. It was when the ship's flying near the end or whatever like that is going when she's going back in to get Newt. I was just oh, that's 80s CGI, kind of look to it.
I will say though, I was quite pleasantly surprised that the Alien Queen is, for me, it's an absolute triumph of a Stan Winston thing, because it's not CGI or anything like that. And it's
for sure.
Again, you can watch hours of stuff on the Blu-rays and stuff about behind the scenes of how it's made, and it's fascinating if you like that kind of thing. But again, it would be boring as crap for a podcast, mainly because it's quite visual as well. But you can see, like I said, the every stage of them building this massive puppet, and the way it was initially, like I said, a frame with just bin bags on it, and then it had a bit more to it, and then it's effectively a giant puppet, and credit to them, for it looks incredible. I'm sure that if anybody's more interested in like weapons and vehicles, they could probably tell me about how good the design of like those was as well. But I glaze over if somebody starts telling me stuff like that, so I don't really care. Sorry, Sandy.
No, it's okay. I did like the production design very much. I thought that it was a more realistic depiction of what future industry would look like than a lot of newer movies do, especially their clothing. It's not outlandish, it's practical and not far off from what, you know, someone out in the field would be wearing, you know, what Ripley wears and stuff like that. I really hate impractical clothing in futuristic movies, and so this one holds the line really good on that. And when they're all eating together in the beginning of the film, just the space set there, and then later when they're all working on the drop ships and the just the design of that set with the power loader. I just really like the design of that. And then also when the Queen first comes out and the way she's backlit, just really beautiful shot there. So I really did appreciate a lot of the production design.
And I have to give a shout out for the creation of the Power Loader, which is rightfully iconic and just brilliant. Just a genius idea that if you've got this giant alien queen, how are you going to face up against it? I know, just put you in the equivalent of a, you know, Japanese mech to fight her.
And it actually looks better than Avatar's version.
It does. It looks really good.
Yeah. And considering it was just used in this one film, the design has proliferated into so many parodies and homages and, you know, various things down the years. It really holds up well. I still can't, as you were talking about the Power Lord, there's still that bit where, you know, it's operated by like this kind of gimbal behind it as it steps forward. So I always kind of see that now, even though you can't see it as such. But other than that, I think it holds up incredibly well.
Now you ruined it.
Oh, well.
I wasn't bothered by that. I will say, being a kind of, you know, film dork, one of the things that I didn't love in the writing is that it really signposts that this is going to be important, because it doesn't just show you them in the background. It's like a whole scene of Ripley going, oh, I can use these things. Look how good I am in this. And I was like, well, this is going to be important. Otherwise, what was this scene about?
Yeah.
And, so I kind of wished
it. And the bomb in the scene, too, was important.
I will say that her using that, though, was also, like, I thought it was done well enough to where I didn't go, okay. But because I had seen it before, because of like she's trying to prove that she belongs with the other Marines.
Yeah.
And so that's why I gave it a pass on that. But I do have a small production design trivia that I just found that I think is really cool. It's while filming the scene with Newt in the duct, Carrie Henn kept deliberately blowing her scene so she could slide down the vent, which she later called a slide 3 stories tall. James Cameron finally dissuaded her by saying that if she completed the shot, she could play on the slide as much as she wanted. She did, and he kept his promise.
Nice.
Oh, that's cool.
So that was actually a big slide that she got to go on, and she kept messing up her scene. I think that's really funny.
That's awesome.
Nice one. Yeah. Yeah, I think it really holds up well. And, you know, you look at it now. And I'm not just on about with regards to the technology, but when you look at the design of the alien creature in this compared to Alien, the first one obviously was very slow, very deliberate. I love that these things move really fast in this.
And very, you know, realistic.
There's one scene, it's my favorite scene actually. It's what you referred to earlier, Mike, where, you know, they said they should be inside the room and then they look up and but when Hudson starts firing, they all start dropping through the ceiling, and then you see them hopping over the counters. I think that looks amazing even to this day. It looks so realistic and I love that.
Yeah, I just love the Alien Queen as well. I know some people really don't like the Alien Queen and don't like it as an addition, but I think even in the movies that I don't like Alien 4 and Alien vs. Predator, I love the scenes with the Alien Queen. I don't know why. I just think such a cool design and a cool idea.
I also think it needs, story-wise, it needed the Alien Queen. I think it's important to that. Because honestly, I too was like, well, originally watching, like, wait, how does this even work? Like, you know, I mean, I know it's alien, but my brain still wanted to know logistically, you know, how everything processed that way. And so I enjoyed the Queen.
Cool. So the only thing that we've got left to talk about really is sound and soundtrack. So have you got anything on that, Mike?
I haven't. I did read something about James Horner had, as you said, very little time to do it. So he had to reuse a lot of kind of stuff he'd done for other projects, and
yeah,
I think there's some reuse of Jerry Goldsmith's score from the original, but I didn't really look into it because there is more your area than mine.
Yeah, there is. There's quite a bit of reusing from Goldsmith's score for the original one, but I didn't know that initially with regards to James Horner. But there is such strong elements from, and you'll know it, mate, from Wrath of Khan.
Of his Trek scores, apparently, yeah. A lot of the stuff he didn't use in this movie, he used in. Did he do 4 as well?
I think that was Leonard Rosenman.
Oh, my bad. Well, maybe Wrath of Khan is what I'm thinking of.
He did Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock. So
that's one of those two. Yeah.
Yeah. The one I'm specifically thinking, when it's the reactor's about to go and they're flying off in the jump ship. That to me is straight out of Wrath of Khan. So yeah, so that's it. What I've got with regards to the soundtrack. I'll say I do like the sounds of the pulse rifles, and I think I do like the introduced as such more commonplace the scream when an alien's been dispatched. I dig that. So obviously, any scene where someone's firing pulse rifles at aliens and getting to squeal and explode, I'm all for that. So yeah, we'll come to our favourites in a minute. But before we move on, and before we get to the audience, is there anything that any of you guys think that we might have missed?
Nope. I thought there was one more thing of trivia that I thought was funny that I found. Bill Paxton continuously apologized to Carrie Henn throughout filming every time Hudson had to swear in front of her. Henn later admitted that she didn't mind, mainly because she really didn't know what any of the words meant. Years later, during cast reunions, Henn had grown up so much that Paxton didn't even recognize her at first.
Oh, wow. Cool. So, yeah, we'll come to our audience feedback. We asked, as always, on our socials if anybody got any opinions on the movie. And how much did we get on this one, Mike?
A fair bit, but not... I mean, I thought that might be a bit more because of the popularity of the movie and how well-known it is. And it's a little more mixed than I was necessarily expecting. Which I'll get into, but do you want me to just start reading it off?
Go for it.
Yeah, well, first of all, we'll deal with Facebook groups. So this is from Northeast Retro Den. Jason Woodhead says, when we asked about, you know, what you think of the film and some various questions, he said, easy 5 out of 5. For me, it's better than the original, even though the original is still a masterclass in suspense and atmosphere. I doubt Ripley would class herself as a hero, just someone with the will and determination to get things done. I don't think I've ever seen the special edition, so that's something I need to rectify ASAP. Definitely a film that I can watch repeatedly without getting bored of it. Yeah, people, watch the special edition. It's the superior version. David Howland in the same group says, it's a 5-star beast of a film. Special edition for the explanations, i.e. guns, and the pre-action scene claiming the alien ship. From the group Action and Sci-Fi Movies of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, Robert Spencer says, game over, man. Game over. Bill Paxton, RIP. Ripley and a forklift did more damage than those Marines. From the group called Alien Anthology, Joshua Walters says, Alien is a 5-star horror. Aliens is 5-star horror action. Aliens wins. Jackie Garn just says, brilliant. Jimmy Walsh says, it's a friggin' 11 out of 10. To which Shug Hugh McGurran replies, it's 8 out of 10 at best. Controversial. Rhett Butler, presumably not that one, says, 7 out of 10.
Said he couldn't give a damn about the film.
I knew you were going to do that.
If he didn't, I was going to.
No, he says it's a 7 out of 10, a fun but overrated action romp. Unfortunately, Cameron removed what made the alien truly alien and turned it into a space bug. Don't really agree, but okay. Richard White says, I love Aliens and the Terminator. Cameron was at his best in the 80s, but despite the excellent industrial setting and some fantastic scenes with the warrior aliens, the brooding Geigerian horror and tight script and casting of Alien will always hold a higher rank than the second film. I give Aliens 8 out of 10 and the director's cut 7.5. Shut up. The sentry gun scene is great, but bloat that was trimmed gave us a film with perfect pacing. Strong disagreement, okay. David Ford said, I would rate it a 2, and that's only because of the title music, to which Richard White replies, you know, I was going to say hot take, but Richard White says it all with his response, my man, that is a shit take. Yeah. Back from NARD, Robbie James Miller says one of the greatest movies put to film. Brett Holdaway says, at the time, a truly great sequel to a great original. There haven't been many. Iconic dialogue. Looking back now, it lacks the visuals of 1 or 3, and it does undermine a lot of the creature's mystery, but a 5 out of 5 on release and a classic. So then, let's see, where were we? Cult Cinema and TV Group. Al Winter says, it's okay, hated it on release, was a huge fan of the original, and this felt like a Vietnam War film in space. Also hate the term xenomorph. A lot of lines that people like make me cringe. Get away from her, you bitch. I've warmed to it more recently, but still think it's a bit of a bloated mess. Gordon Hesketh replied, if it made you cringe that time, what did it do for you in Romulus? To which he replied, I almost had an aneurysm. Me too, with so many points in that movie. Gordon Hesketh himself says, a brilliant film, but not better than the original. Sean Andrew Elam says, as a kid, this was my favourite of the franchise, but as I've gotten older, it's definitely the original that's my personal favourite. The original is a rarity of being a blockbuster and an arthouse horror at the same time. It literally feels like it was created as a piece of art, while the sequel is more of an action blockbuster with Vietnam War overtones, though I still love it. I will also add that Aliens brought the most obnoxious fans to the franchise that just want colonial marines and everything. yeah, I kind of see what you mean with that. So, yeah, now we're going over to, this is Threads. Lord underscore Zathrus says, horror alien, war alien, British alien, French alien, then they get weird. Good summation of the first four movies. Miranda Wheeler 79 says, Aliens is a totally different animal to the first Alien film. This is an action romp, whereas the first movie is a suspense drama. It added a lot more to the mythology of the franchise, and it did cement Sigourney Weaver as the action heroine, though. Callum Rigby says, 5 out of 5 for me. Is Ripley the greatest action hero? I'm going to be controversial and say no, but she's up there. The Marines, just scream and die. Is it better than the original? No, but it's different. Favorite line, this little girl survived longer than you with no weapons and no training. Well, why didn't you put her in charge? And yeah, he says special edition all the way. Fundamentals Pod gives it 5 stars and says, Ripley's definitely at the top of the list for action heroines. The Marines are a lovely addition to the story that bring a lot of quotable moments. The film isn't better, it's just different, and that's the joy of the franchise. It's adaptable. The favorite scene was the showdown with Ripley and the Queen, and either the theatrical or special edition, in their opinion, is fine. Mr. JBW says, I love how iconic the game over man is delivered by Hudson off screen, but it's one of the greatest lines in film. Ripley is iconic and badass. The Marines underestimated the enemy and it showed during the briefing, so they kind of screamed and died. But Hicks is a legend. Hudson is a bit of a bitch. Two very different films. I prefer Alien, but this is an excellent movie. Special edition, I feel, flows a lot better and makes the relationship between Ripley and Newt make much more sense. And that's it.
Nice one. Well, that's what they thought. In a few minutes, we'll find out what we here in the studio thought to it. But before that, because it's a silver screen regular flavor, we'll go around and ask everybody their favorite character, moment or scene, and line. So we'll come to you first, Sandy, on this one again. Who's your favorite character in this one?
I hate to say it, but it's going to have to be Ripley as my favorite character. With the second being the Queen herself.
Oh, fair enough. And do you have a favorite moment or scene?
I do, actually. It's when Ripley and Newt are in the nest, and kind of like this silent negotiation between the Queen and yes. Ripley, where she's like, you know, I'll let you and your child leave if you let me and my children be, and then Ripley just saying "fuck you, I'm out," you know, burning everything. That was
because the egg starts hatching, and she's just kind of like, "Oh, I'm gonna have to kill."
Yeah. So I just really love that scene.
Cool. And do you have a favorite line?
It was just maligned, but I love the "get away from her, you bitch." I just love that scene because it's just, it's just like, you know, it's on now, and again, just her motherly instincts kicking in, and you know it's going to be a fight between the two of them, and it has been this whole time.
Cool. Whaley, do you have a what's your favorite character?
My favorite character, it's a toss-up. I mean, Sigourney Weaver is great, but I think that's too easy for me to say that again, and also I should do something different. I do think Newt is my favorite character addition to the franchise in this at this point. Like, I think they brought a whole lot to this movie. Otherwise, it's just, you know, Ripley with a bunch of Marines who don't know how to listen and stuff. So I'm going to say Newt's my favorite character, followed closely by Ripley. Favorite scene? I mentioned it earlier, and it is one of my favorite action scenes in there. But for straight up suspense, I'm going to go with the scene where Ripley wakes up with Newt in the thing, and Burke has sabotaged them to try to get them. That brings so much tension and stuff like that, whether or not they're going to survive or get out of there and whatnot. So I think that was my favorite scene. And my favorite quote is from Private Frost when
they get told, you're gonna use mine here.
What the hell are we supposed to use, man? Harsh language?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's you just nailed my favorite line there. So
yeah, it's so good. I mean, there's so many good ones, and you guys have already quoted some of them throughout this podcast so far, but Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Cool. Mike?
Yeah, my favorite character in this is Ripley. It's her movie. It's very much her we follow, capitalizing on her familiarity from the first movie and giving her a lot of the more heroic moments. It also turns her into the aforementioned post-feminist icon. My favorite moment or scene, there's so many, and I don't want to downplay the others, but I've got to go with the very obvious Power Loader versus Queen fight. I've always loved that since I was young and watched this. And my favorite line, exactly like Sandy, just for sheer iconic nature, it's got to be, get away from her, you bitch. So good. Ooh. That it was referenced in this scream too.
Yeah, I've got to kind of agree with Whaley here. My favorite character is Newt. Favorite line, the harsh language one. I think the as far as scenes go, I think I'm going to go for that one where I mentioned earlier, which is where they drop through the ceiling in the, you know, the firefighting close quarters kind of thing going. So yeah, that's our favorite moments, our favorite highlights from the movie. So now we're coming to the end, and we're going to go around, ask all our guests, including Mike and myself, what their final conclusions are and a score out of 5. So yeah, I'll come to you first on this one, Whaley. What's your final thoughts on Aliens, and what would you give it out of 5 stars?
Aliens is a fantastic film. It's an action sci-fi horror, which combines 3 favorite genre types of mine. While I still have a special place in my heart for Alien, with it being more of a horror sci-fi, I still think Aliens is insanely well done, and is goals for making a sci-fi action horror movie ever. If you can get something that's half as good as this, you'll be successful. I am going to give it 4.5 out of 5.
Fair enough. Sandy?
I also think this is just really an iconic film. Like you had said earlier, DK, one of the best sequels just ever. I like how we start what appears like moments after the last film ends, but then find out it's 57 years later. I like that the predicaments they found themselves in weren't predicated on doing something dumb, you know, with the exception, of course, of Burke's decision as a part of actual plot development. But, you know, all of our characters were pretty smart once we got on planet and into the action. My only disappointment was to see that in 2179, we're still not fastening both sides of our overalls. But other than that, I thought it was a great movie. And I actually gave it a 4.6 out of 5.
4.6, okay. Do you want me to go first, Mike? Because I know what you're going to end up with here.
I'll go first if you want. It's not as long as it usually is.
Are you sure, dude?
Yeah.
All right, yeah, go for it.
Okay, so I said, what a movie. Full disclosure, I'm a massive fan of pre-Avatar James Cameron movies. And genuinely believe there's not a bad one in the bunch, Piranha 2 accepted, for obvious reasons. Even so, this ranks second only to Terminator 2 for me in his filmography, and it's firmly in my top 10 films of all time. Why? The stakes are higher than in the first film, the world expands with richer, more compelling characters, and the action is both varied and thrilling. It's endlessly quotable, packed with unforgettable visuals, and full of moments that have become iconic in their own right. The original made Ripley a survivor, this one makes her a bona fide badass. Where the first film subtly hinted at psychosexual tension and gender politics, this one wears its themes proudly on its sleeve. It's good mom versus bad mom, and just in case we missed the point, we're given a little girl far more potent than a cat as the symbol of what needs protecting. Yes, this film works as a top-tier action flick, but it's also loaded with themes we've discussed: motherhood, war, corporate greed, bigotry. From a film student's perspective, it's stunning. The lived-in mise-en-scene, the sets, the camera motion, the meticulously detailed weapons, vehicles, creatures, and of course the legendary alien queen. I could gush about it for hours, but I think you know what's coming, so I'll cut to the chase. One express elevator to 5 stars going down.
Fair enough.
Pressed with the mouth inside your mouth.
Exactly. Yeah, I've got to say, I've never, you know, anybody that's listened to the podcast knows I'm not the biggest James Cameron fan, but there's a couple of his movies that are just gold, and this is one of them. Strong characters, really good script that moves along at a brisk pace, some great performances in this. Every time I watch it, and I did watch it, as I say, once a week, it just captures my imagination. I don't think I've ever gotten tired of it. And yeah, it still holds up to this day. So in a weird twist, I'm going to finally agree with Mike and give it 5 out of 5. Which means, adding all those together, it gives Aliens a final silver screen score of 4.7 out of 5. So I think that's wow. I think it's earned its stripes there.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. So if you've enjoyed this and you want to go and watch Aliens again, you're quite welcome. You know, but until then. If you want to come back and see Silver Screen Podcast again, you're more than welcome. We've got some good stuff coming up. And, if you've enjoyed The Cut of our Jib, then please like and subscribe. All that's left to do is thank everybody for turning up today. So, first of all, I'll come to you, Whaley. Thanks for joining us on this one, man.
Oh, thanks for having me, man. I always enjoy coming and talking about any kind of movies with you guys and TV.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully we'll have a bit more on that in future. But do you have anything to promote while you're here? Any upcoming projects or anywhere the listeners can get in touch?
I don't have anything currently going on, but if you want to find me, I'm always Michael Whaley on Blue Sky, Instagram, TikTok, and come check me out on there.
Cool. Sandy, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank y'all very much for having me. And as usual, I'm still kind of underground, pretty much only on Mike's Discord. But I did want to give a shout out to Burke's business card. What a fine piece of futuristic production design.
Nice. And what about you, Mike? And obviously, people know where they can find you. They just look on the link tree. But what have we got coming up on Silver Screen?
Well, as I said, I can't remember if it was off air or I mentioned it when we were recording. We basically are doing the jigsaw puzzle pieces to my life season with 3 of my favorite films of all time in a row. So do join us on Silver Screen Regular for the next one of these in a week's time, and then on Silver Screen Cinema Classics for the 3rd and final the week after that. And I won't say any more about that because I'll leave them as a surprise, even though I think we can kind of all gather what they're going to be. So.
That's fair enough. I'm going to be doing a cult classics. I think the next one due out cult classics is the start of July. And I've been joined on that again by Mike, honestly, can't get rid of the bastard, in which we'll be discussing the Bruce Lee classic Enter the Dragon. But until then. God. Until then, I'm glad you've joined us today. Once again, thank you to all the guests. And if you like the show, like, subscribe, join us next time. And until then, bye.
Game over, man. Game over.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Mike Wilson and DK. Behind the Scenes section by DK. Additional material by Mike Wilson. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. Link to all of these places can be found via the link tree listed in this episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production, created, produced, and edited by Mike Wilson. We'd love it if you'd like, subscribe, and share us around like a beloved old video cassette. We hope to see you next time for more movie magic. Until then, remember, life moves pretty fast, so stop and watch a movie now and then.